a little zoom in a rocket ship. Off we go on a trip, heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zooming to the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha, 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hi there, and welcome to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 in Vancouver. Today on the show, we've got a couple of things lined up. The first part of the show is going to be a bit of a hodgepodge of science news. We'll drop in and look at what's going on with blogs and scientific publishing. And I've got a really neat story about one species becoming three, and another neat story about three-way symbiosis in Yosemite National Park, which sounds a lot kinky than it, a lot more kinky than it is, but it's a fun story nonetheless. I've got a whole whack of science-y events around town that you might want to check out. And in the second part of the show, we'll talk a bit about the brain and memory and the role of sleep in improving your memory. We'll also consider the value of different model organisms in the study of the brain physiology and in brain biology. Along those lines, I had a good chat with Dr. Vanessa Auld, who is here in Vancouver at University of British Columbia. She's a principal investigator in the Department of Zoology. And I chatted with her about why fruit flies are a good tool for studying the brain. And there's quite a lot more to be mixed in as well, as time permits. I'd like to let you know that Julia, my co-host, stationed in Calgary, and I are planning to co-host with the help of a telephone a couple of shows this summer. So we would love to hear your questions or suggestions, those sorts of things that we could address in these upcoming shows. So do get in touch with us, and you can do that by email. So why not email us at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. So that's myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. And let us know what you'd like to be hearing on the show. Now, I always get a kick out of the fact that My Science Project follows on from a kick and hip-hop show. It's certainly an interesting transition, and I'm going to do my best today in the theme of the brain, which we'll be getting to in the second part of the show. This tune hardly needs any introduction at all, and it's Cypress Hill.
Were you trying to get crazy with this, eh? Don't you know I'm loco?
The sun of sand. Don't make me wax it, hectic These pigs wanna blow my house down. Head underground to the next town. They get mad when they come to raid my pad. And I'm out in the night, who's scared? Yes, I'm the pirate pilot of this ship. If I dip with the ultraviolet dream, hide from the red light beam. Now do you believe in the unseen? Look, but don't make your eyes strain. A nigga like me is going insane.
Cypress Hill with Insane in the Brain. Like I said, a song that hardly needs any introduction whatsoever, but it definitely does a good job of setting us up for our show today. And in the second part, we're going to be talking a little bit about the brain and memory. But for now, like I said, there's a bit of a mixed bag of neato mosquito news from the world today. And there's a whole lot of blog stuff going on in the world of science blog, and it turns out that online science blogs are sparking some novel controversies lately. So I've got two stories for you, and both of these stories speak to the power and credit now ascribed to many online blogs in communicating and commenting on science. So in the first story, we have Reed Cartwright, who at the time was a PhD student at the University of Georgia, and he had an online blog called De Rerum Natura. And he did what many bloggers do. He read a scientific paper and he commented on it in his blog. What he didn't know was that those comments and his musings on a primary paper that he read in the journal Nature would soon earn him an authorship. And this is what happened. Reed read the paper in Nature, and it was a paper about a certain mutation in Arabidopsis. And he thought that really there was a better hypothesis that fit with the data. And he described that hypothesis in his blog. 6 months later, another scientist by the name of Luca Comai got in touch with Reed. Luca had independently come up with the very same hypothesis as Reed Cartwright. And he was in the process of publishing data to support the hypothesis in a journal called Plant Cell. And during the revision and writing process of Luca Comai's article, he was made aware of Reed's blog and the online publishing of a similar hypothesis to his own. Then, in consultation with the editors at Plant Cell, and in light of the fact that a lot of journals don't normally include citations to blogs in their references, Reed became co-author on Luca Comai's publication. Now, I would have to say straight off that that's an uncommonly generous gesture by Dr. Comai. The scientific community, as many of you may be all too familiar with, is routinely highly territorial of ideas and pretty darn greedy for authorship. But what is interesting about the story is that it appears to be the very first example of a blog leading to a scientific and academic publication. And overall, it certainly underscores the value of blogs and sort of the live atmosphere of the internet to communicate and share ideas. And you could see how very quickly the internet could be used in science to build interactions between scientists, particularly those who are a great distance apart. And those are some of the values that are often abandoned these days by those of us who are desperate for publications and hungry for grant money. And I've actually heard of a few labs who are attempting to create an open lab or online lab research concept where lab members daily give updates online about the work that they're doing and their findings, as small the steps as they may be. This kind of creates a live atmosphere, and it certainly will be interesting to see if that catches on in any way. Now, the other story is about another blog, called Retrospectacle, by a PhD student of the name Shelley Batts. And what Shelley had blogged about caught the eye of the Journal of Science of Food and Agriculture. So, quite similarly to Reed, Shelley had blogged about an article published in the Journal of Science of Food and Agriculture and included two graphics from that particular journal. as supporting images to her comments. And within 24 hours of that happening, the Society of Chemical Industry, who are the owners of the journal in question, sent Shelley an email threatening legal action if those figures were not removed. Dozens of bloggers really rapidly responded to this situation, and it wasn't long before the blogging community, supported by Slashdot and Boing Boing, had great impact and articles appearing on those two websites, in addition to all these other blogs. And yet this sort of blog styling, commenting on a paper that you've read and sometimes providing the odd figure to support your comments or to assist the reader in understanding your comments is really, really common among science bloggers. In fact, it's pretty much the format in sort of the real world situations in conferences and lab meetings and so on. You know, this sort of approach to thinking about science and thinking about scientific research is absolutely critical to critical thinking, to discussion about scientific data, whether it's supporting it or not. It can't ever be a bad thing. But after all that attention and all that readership drawn to this issue, the Society of Chemical Industry quickly apologized for the actions. And I think one of the big issues that comes into play here with what Shelley Batts had done on her blog pulls on an issue that's sort of unique to U.S. copyright law, and it's an issue called fair use. And I'm not sure if there is sort of a counterpart to that in Canada, but I'd be surprised if there wasn't. Anyway, fair use in terms of U.S. copyright law has sort of four considerations when you're looking at the use of what would normally be copyright material. And those four considerations are, one, to consider the purpose and character of the use, including whether such use is of commercial nature or is for nonprofit educational purposes, presumably favoring nonprofit educational purposes over commercial nature. The second consideration is the nature of the copyrighted work to begin with. The third is the amount and substantiality of the portion used in relation to the copyrighted work as a whole. So I'm assuming here that using a small amount, like the odd figure, is fair use or fair game. And finally, the fourth consideration is the effect of the use upon the potential market for or value of the copyrighted work. So it's certainly an interesting couple of issues that are raised now in the blog sphere of science writing. And if you want to check out these two particular blogs that have made headlines, the first one was De Rerum Natura, and that can be found at dererumnatura.us. And the second was Retrospectical, and you can find that at scienceblogs.com/retrospectical. So those are some pretty interesting cutting-edge stories for you from the world of science blogging. And coming up, I'm going to tell you a little bit about this three-way in Yosemite National Park. But before we do that, here is Philip Glass with Metamorphosis 3. Hi there, you're listening to My Science Project, and on today's show we're starting off with a bit of a mishmash of news stories, but before we kick off into the next one, I want to let you know about a pretty neat thing that's taking place in Richmond Nature Park. It's happening on Sundays in May, including the 13th and the 27th, from 1 to 2:30 p.m. on those Sundays. It's absolutely free. It's for all ages, though if you're under 12, you should bring an adult along with you. And this, I think, is just great because you'll get involved in monitoring wildlife in the park. You'll join biologist Libor Mikalak, apologies if I butchered that name, at the Richmond Nature Park. And on May 13th, you'll have the opportunity to learn how to band hummingbirds and songbirds in the park and to identify the birds that live there. And if you go along on May 27th, you'll be involved in looking for amphibians using various traps and searching techniques. So that's certainly a fun way for budding biologists to have a great day in Richmond Nature Park. And for more information about that, you can call 604-718-6188. So that's May 13th and May 27th at 1 p.m. in Richmond Nature Park. And it's kind of appropriate to the next story that's coming up because this is a bit of research that came out of Yosemite National Park. And it has to do with symbiosis. And symbiosis is the close association or living together of two types of organisms. And although living close together is not necessarily beneficial for both, although it could be, So each of the organisms will either benefit, have a neutral effect, or in some cases a detrimental effect based on this association. And symbiosis is kind of a broad term, and it covers more specific relationships such as parasitism, mutualism, commensalism, and that sort of thing. In the case of parasitism, you've got two organisms living in symbiosis, living in close association, where one benefits and the other suffers. So a pretty common example of a parasitic relationship that is detrimental to humans is infection with the parasite Ascaris, which is commonly known as the roundworm. And it's estimated to affect actually 25% of the world, the roundworm, and has a lot to do with food and water sanitation. Now, in contrast, we have mutualism, and in this, both organisms benefit. Sort of the classic example, commonly depicted in cartoons and so forth, is the Egyptian plover bird and the crocodile. And this mutual symbiotic relationship sees the bird preying on parasites that are found on the crocodile. And those parasites would potentially be harmful to the crocodile, so the bird chowing down on those parasites is definitely a benefit to the crocodile. Meanwhile, the crocodile openly invites the bird to hunt on its body for those parasites, and in some cases will even open its jaw and allow the bird to enter the mouth safely to hunt. So not only has the bird got a safe feeding ground, but presumably by hanging out side by side with a crocodile, the crocodile is also scaring away a fair few predators which might have struck that bird. So that's what mutualism is. It's a mutually beneficial association between a couple of organisms. Now, what I'm going to tell you about is a symbiotic ménage à trois that was recently reported in the journal Science by Luis Marquez and colleagues. Now, it's been well established that mutualistic symbiosis exists between the tropical panic grass, or Dicanthelium lanuginosum, and the fungus Curvularia protuberata. Now, experiments conducted by these folks demonstrated that when the root zones of this grass is heated up to 65 degrees Celsius, if it's not symbiotic, so if it's not harboring a fungus inside, that grass will shrivel and die, whereas the symbiotic plants can survive the heating regime of up to 65 degrees Celsius. Now, if you take a look at growth of the fungus or growth of the grass when they're just on their own and not in association, you find that they can only grow comfortably up to about 38 degrees Celsius. They also noted that the symbiotic grass has enhanced growth rate and increased drought tolerance just under normal conditions in the absence of heat stress. So what was really cool about the Science paper is that they show that the symbiotic relationship is dependent on yet another player. So it's not just the fungus in the plant, it's the virus in the fungus in the plant. They've named, it's a new virus that they've decided to name the Kuvalaria Thermal Tolerance Virus, or CTHTV, and it infects the fungus. This particular project got its start when the group leader, Marilyn Rusinick, noticed that plants growing in warmer regions of Yosemite National Park showed evidence of viral infection, while those plants found in the cooler regions, so presumably not requiring the thermal tolerance conveyed to it by the virus, those plants in the cooler regions appeared to be spared infection. So her team and showed that the virus can be isolated from the fungus, first of all, which is pretty standard in the stream of logic here, and then in a then in the next study demonstrated that fungal isolates without the virus, or cured, so-called cured of the virus, were unable to confer that heat tolerance to the panic grass. And then in the complementary study, by adding that virus back, the heat sensitivity returned with the reintroduction of the virus. So interestingly, they were also able to demonstrate that not only could that virus in the fungus confer heat tolerance to the panic grass, but also to Solanum lycopersicon, which is a long and difficult and Latin name for the tomato. So it's a pretty neat example here of a naturally occurring virus making plants resistant to heat. And so often we try to make plants resistant to viruses, but this is certainly a novel and natural mechanism by which viruses can induce heat tolerance in plants. Now, sticking with the world of plants and animals, so often you hear about the rapid rate of extinction of species. In fact, scientists estimate that there are 10 to 30 million plant and animal species on the planet. Most of them remain unidentified, but each year as many as 50,000 species disappear, and most of them are dying off because of human activity and urbanization and expanding agricultural practices. Now, sometimes you hear about new species in the news, but the story that I've got for you today is where one species has become three. And this is what happened. Recently, genetic analysis has revealed that the medicinal leech, or we're doing lots of Latin names here today too, I'll give it to you, it's the Herudo medicinalis, was formerly classified as one species, but in fact, it's three. And while I'm really thrilled to be reporting on the addition of two new species in the menu of blood-sucking organisms, the big impact of this paper is on years and years of research on what was formerly thought to be just one species. Now, possibly you don't know so much about leech taxonomy, and I didn't before sometime last night, but what I have learned is that leech taxonomy dates back to 1827, when a French zoologist by the name of Alfred Moquin-Tandon published a description of several leech species. And later on, he sort of changed his mind. Instead of arguing that there were several leech species, what he thought is that he had one species that differed with a few color variations. Turns out Alfred's first instincts might have been the correct one, and it's only just being sorted out now. This year, sequence analysis performed by Mark Sedal of the American Museum of Natural History and published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society has confirmed what was known as Herudo medicinalis may be one of Herudo medicinalis, Herudo verbena, or Herudo orientalis. And these leeches are commercially available because they're actually used quite commonly in research. So they had a look at what is commercially available and known as Herudo medicinalis. And in fact, it was 100% pure Herudo verbena. So there's really a re-examination here of what species have been used. Leeches, like I said, are a popular model organism in the study of neurobiology. But it's not generally predicted that these findings, the division of this one species into three, is going to have a major impact on data. A lot of people predict that these three species of leeches will behave and perform experimentally in a pretty similar way. But it certainly will catch the attention of the FDA, who have cleared one of these leech species for use in promoting blood flow after reconstructive surgery. And it'll have to be shown that those other leech species have equivalent therapeutic potential in order to have a similar approval for therapeutic use. Now, before you go raising your glass to the growing leech community, Dr. Sedal also points out that one of those species, the H. medicinalis, is actually listed on the endangered species list. So this is certainly a crazy story of one species becoming three. Now, last week, I was pretty excited about the discovery of a band. Sorry, last month. I was pretty excited about the discovery of a band called the Puppettes. And I want to give you another quick song from these gals. This one is called Your Kisses Are Wasted on Me.
I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain. I'd unravel every riddle for any individual in trouble or in pain.
With the thoughts you'd be thinking, you could be another Lincoln if you only had a brain.
Oh, I tell you why, the ocean's near the shore. I could think of things I never thought before, and then I'd sit and think some more. I would not be just a nuffin, my head all full of stuffin, my heart all full of pain. I would dance and be merry, life would be a ding-a-dairy if I only had a brain.
You're listening to My Science Project, and as I promised, we were going to spend the second part of the show talking about the brain. And Wizard of Oz has set us up so nicely. The brain, as many of you will be well aware, is the most complex organ in the human body. It weighs in at about 1.4 kilograms, and it has something like 100 billion nerve cells. Even more complexity comes from the mind-boggling connectivity of these neurons. Each neuron can make up thousands or even tens of thousands of connections with other neurons through synapses. I think the combinatorial complexity of all of this is absolutely staggering. Moreover, the strength of these connections and these synapses is constantly changing, and it gives the brain this property of plasticity or changeability. And it's also estimated that 1 million new connections are made for every second of our lives, which is a new finding for me. Absolutely crazy to think about that 1 million new connections are made for every second of our lives. And these changing connections, whether they're made or lost or strengthened or weakened, are what are involved in making memories, shaping personalities, learning habits, the whole gamut of mental activity. But what's the difficult question, I think, is how on earth are we making progress in studying such a complex organ? And it turns out that the answer appears to be in the careful selection of a model organism, and in that age-old principle, keep it simple. The secret of making this progress is the selection of a manageable model organism, and that's probably the secret to a lot of good scientific research, particularly in biology. And I had the opportunity to speak with Dr. Vanessa Auld, and she is an assistant professor in the Department of Zoology at University of British Columbia. And Dr. Auld uses the fruit fly to study the nervous system. Turns out that there are a lot of structural similarities between both vertebrate and invertebrate systems. And it's thought that both systems have analogous mechanisms in the development of the nervous system. In fact, at the molecular level, there are a lot of Drosophila, which is commonly known as the fruit fly. A lot of Drosophila genes have homologs with similar functions in vertebrates. And so you can already see that a case is developing that Drosophila, a simple organism, might be a good one for attempting to get a grasp of what's going on in the brain. Obviously, the fruit fly is a simpler organism, and it's useful for studying the nervous system, including glial cells, which is one of the focuses in Dr. Auld's lab. So I had a chance to speak with Dr. Auld about what a glial cell is and what it does. And right off the bat, I asked her why she chose the fruit fly as her tool for studying the brain.
Straight off, it's not a very smart animal. So you can imagine it has a very small brain. There's only thousands of neurons as opposed to billions of neurons in our brain. And they make thousands of synaptic connections or connections between themselves, whereas we make trillions of connections. So if you're going to learn how a brain develops and gets wired up, it's a lot easier to use it on a simple model system than using it on a human or a mouse or even a higher vertebrate like fish is far more complicated than a fly. So the fly has a very simple advantage because it's simple, easy to work with, and very, very simple. Stupid animal, really. not intelligent in any way. But the wiring, the development, is completely conserved. So if you look at the proteins that are found in Drosophila necessary to make a nervous system, they're exactly the same as the proteins found in humans to make a nervous system, but there's a lot less of them. So whereas a fly might have one or two copies of a protein, the human would have five or six copies of that same protein and use it in a complicated manner. Whereas if we can figure out how those simple proteins are used in the fly, then we can, by analogy, use that into the humans, you know, or mouse or whatever animal you're interested in.
So the neural network is sort of a scalable model
Precisely, and the fundamental biology behind how do you make, let's say, a chemical synapse between two neurons is a fundamental basis of all nervous systems. So if you look at a model organism like Drosophila or a model organism like C. elegans, which is a nematode, that process is precisely the same as in us during our development. So it's a lot easier to dissect out and understand it from a simple organism as compared to a human or a mouse or something complicated.
And I know in your group you're looking at glial cells. Could you tell me what a glial cell is?
So glial cell are the poor glial cells. They're ignored. So the fancy cells of the nervous system are the neurons, the ones that take the signal or the action potential across your body. And they're the signaling cells. But in most brains, including our brains, they're completely outnumbered by the glial cells. So there's sections in our brain, there's 50 glial cells for every one neuron. And the glial cells don't take the electrical signal, so they get kind of shunted aside, but they do everything else. So they give they give nutrients or glucose to the neurons, so they feed the neurons. They take away all the metabolites, or they make sure the environment is totally perfect for the neurons. They're ones that protect the neurons, so they do all the housekeeping duties. So they're really vitally important. And then the very most important thing that the glial cells do us, especially in us, is they make the sheath. So they make an insulating sheath, they wrap around the axons, and in us, in mammals, they make the myelin. And the myelin, again, is something that insulates and allows the nervous signal or the nervous action potential to go super fast in us. If you take away the glial cells, you take away the myelin, then you get diseases like multiple sclerosis. So the glial cells are really, really important, but they just don't get the press that the neurons do.
So is your work is focusing on multiple sclerosis as well?
Well, that's one of the problems with working on insects. So Insects don't need to have fast nervous system signals because they're really small. So if you've ever seen a Drosophila melanogaster, it's a tiny little organism, and it doesn't need to have myelin. So myelin only actually comes on in the evolutionary process when you start getting into bony fish. Before that, the animals got around without having myelin by making their neurons really, really large. And so insects, squids, lobsters, crabs, none of those animals have myelin. They just have the glial wrap, they have the insulation, but they don't do the myelin process. So what we're really interested in is how does that glial wrap, that insulating wrap, happen? Because if you take away the insulating wrap in any animal, the nervous system doesn't work. So we're looking at the very, very first process that says a glial cell will see a long tube of an axon, see it, and then slowly wrap around it and make a nice kind of, you can think of it as a plastic coat on the wire, that kind of idea, making that insulating wrap.
Genetically speaking, why are Drosophila so great?
Well, they have a lot less genes than we do, So that makes it life a lot easier. They breed very quickly. So every 10 to 12 days, there's a new generation. They have four chromosomes, and one of them is very small, so we can actually most of the time ignore it. So it has very simple genetics. It's been studied for over 100 years, so there's all sorts of genetic tricks that we can use to manipulate the genome. And one of the most powerful things is making Drosophila transgenic animals is incredibly simple. So we could add genes back into the genome. We can take them out by doing mutagenesis. So the genetic manipulations are incredibly fast and simple. Things you cannot do in mice, you can do in fruit flies within 10 to 12 days. So that makes things a lot faster.
Am I right to think that they don't have recombination? Something that's stuck in my mind.
That's really sad. Yeah, so I like fruit flies. Working on Drosophila is a fantastic organism, but one of the problems with working fruit flies is they don't have something called homologous recombination. So you can't take a gene and introduce it into the genome by just literally replacing that gene with its own gene in the genome. Something you can do in mice really easily and something you can do in a lot of different organisms. Drosophila doesn't do that, which is annoying. So it's a good organism. Actually, there's no perfect organism. So, for instance, Drosophila has the speed of genetics. It has the beautiful capability of doing some lovely in vivo imaging. So we can look live in the animal as these cells are developing using fluorescent proteins. That's very easy. But we can't do things like homologous recombination. And then if you were to talk to the C. elegans people who work on nematodes, they would say, well, our organism is better because the genetics is far more rapid. They can do recombination. They can do all sorts of different techniques. But their glial cells, if you want to study glial neuronal interactions, is not so sophisticated. And it's much harder to do things like physiology in C. elegans because they're really small. If you look at another model organism like zebrafish or mouse, the genetics is easy to do, but it's long-term because the breeding time of these animals is much, much longer. So each organism has its advantages and disadvantages.
That was UBC's assistant professor in the Department of Zoology, Dr. Vanessa Auld. And as she said, there's no perfect organism for studying the brain, but there are certain advantages to many different ones. And another scientist, Dr. Eric Kandel, he used the sea slug in order to address questions about how memories are formed. And for his work, he shared the 2000 Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine for exactly this research on the physiological basis of memory storage in neurons. And he shared that prize, as I mentioned, with two others who also did work on cell signaling in neurons, and they were, or and are, Arvid Carlson and Paul Greengard. So together they shared an interest in the question, how does the brain change when you make or lose memories? And they used the sea slug, as I said, to answer these sorts of questions. Similarly to the Drosophila, sea slugs offer the advantage of having only 20,000 nerve cells compared to the billions found in the human brain. And additionally, they're famous for having the largest nerve cells. In fact, their nerve cells are visible to the naked eye. You don't need a microscope or anything to see those cells. Dr. Kandel himself has recently published a somewhat autobiographical book of his life and his research on the brain, and it's full of all kinds of scientific research and description, a very elegant description, and that book is In Search of Memory, The Emergence of a New Science of Mind. And in it, he describes some of his own groundbreaking findings that show that learning produces changes in behavior by modifying the strength of connections between nerve cells. And he's demonstrated that there is an altered and increased strength in synapses that occur in response to changes in gene expression. So increased strength is consequently linked to memory, and loss or decreased strength is linked to loss of memory. And he's also done some research to demonstrate that synaptic strength varies with age. He suggests that as you grow older, you're unable to make such strong synaptic connections. And it's sort of a finding that supports that old cliche that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Now, I've got a little bit more news for you, a little bit more on this topic of brain and memory. But before we get to that, I'm going to play for you Cold Brains by Beck.
Cold brains, unmoved, untouched, unglued, alone at last. No thoughts, no mind to rot behind a trail of disasters. A final curse, abandoned curse, we ride. Bent, obscene, I lay upon the gravel. They worm of hope, a hangman's rope pulls me one way or the other. A final curse, abandoned hearse, we ride. Song is heard no longer in the evacuated heavens. And the drain is drawn and drained and gone, and on it doesn't matter. A final curse, abandoned curse, we ride. Corroded to the bone.
this is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I shit.
Breakfast with the Browns.
So whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of cool.
Join your favorite Brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electropop loungecore.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic, Brown.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense, and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds fit, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville.
You know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but you, man, you're going to have a hell of a time saying what it is.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, and this is My Science Project. And, you know, I used to think that Tom Waits had had a song for every scientific topic I could think of, and now I'm starting to think that it's Beck who's written those songs for every scientific topic I can think of. So we'll see how that plays out. And before we say goodbye today and usher in the next show, I just want to tell you a little bit about what's going on in the study of memory and how that is impacted by how well you get to sleep at night. So building on the work of Dr. Eric Kandel, the Nobel laureate, and of course the work of many others, the process of memory storage is being better and better described. Right now, the leading mechanism is a process called long-term potentiation, or LTP. And in this process, connections between individual brain cells get stronger, and the more often they are used, such as during learning, that provides strength to the connections between individual brain cells, and sort of in this popular concept of brain gymnastics or brain gym. More specifically, and onto a molecular point, a group from the European Molecular Biology Laboratory has now identified a key receptor molecule, and that molecule is called TRKB. It's on the surface of brain cells in the hippocampus, and it's absolutely required for LTP. And they determined this in mice, and these mice were defective for TRKB. And when TRKB was defective, they were unable to initiate LTP. So in other words, they were unable to be trained and develop new connections. And absolutely, the past 6 months has seen a flush of data that supports the notion that a good night's sleep is good for the brain. This news may come a little too late for those undergrads who have spent the better part of April cramming for exams, but it's interesting nonetheless, I think. One study from Harvard Medical School suggests that a waking rest is not as good as a sleeping rest in being able to call lists of related words and extract themes from that list. So what they did is they took a group of subjects and introduced them to a collection of related words and then allowed either a long waking rest or a sleeping rest of equal duration. This experiment was led by Bob Stickgold, and it suggests that people were better able to recall the words after sleeping and also better able to identify themes shared by those words. The subjects that had waking rests forgot 25% more themes than the sleeping counterparts. Dr. Stickgold, who is a leading researcher with an interest in sleep deprivation and learning, goes on to argue that sleep helps us extract rules from our experiences. But it turns out that sleep will only help you with sort of factual memory rather than active memory. And in another study, it was demonstrated that even a short nap can improve your ability on some simple tests. So in this case, the experimental subjects are also known as humans, were asked to memorize pairs of words, and that would test factual learning. And they were also asked to practice tracing images in a mirror, and that would test action learning. And when the candidates were tested straight after the learning episode and then tested again 6 hours later, those who were permitted to nap for an hour before the retest scored 15% better in the factual test than the non-nappers. But no better results were seen in the action test. Now, before I sign off, I want to let you know about a couple events that are going on around town. We've got Café Scientifique coming up on May 22nd, and I'm really excited about this one. I think it's going to be great. The speaker is Dr. Jamie Matthews, who is Associate Professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of British Columbia. And he will be speaking about the search for Terra Nova, or the search for new planets. And I think he even promises to touch on a little bit about science fiction writers and how they seem to be looking over the shoulders of planetary scientists looking for real-life settings and some real hardcore science to back up some of their stories. So that will be Tuesday, May 22nd at the Railway Club. It's always free. It always starts at 7:30. And if you'd like to get more information or hear more about Café Scientifique, you can email info@cafesci-fan.com. And there's also some pretty neat things going on at Science World this weekend. There is a theme day called Gold Rush from 11 to 3 p.m. in Lab A, where you can join Yukon Dan to learn the tricks of the trade about panning for gold. And the following weekend, May 12th and 13th, they're doing a session on clothing technology at Science World here in Vancouver, where you can learn about the different materials and types of technologies that go into making outdoor sports clothing. And they've got a few staff and experts from Arc'teryx in to let you know a little bit more about that. And the final thing, taking its cue from The Iron Chef, a great reality TV show, Science World is hosting The Iron Scientist. So you get one featured item and you'll find out the endless possible inventions with that. So come and test your creativity with The Iron Scientist Challenge at 1 p.m. May 12th at Science World. So you heard a lot about sleeping and memory in the brain, and since a good sleep is going to help your memory, I'm going to leave you with a sleeping pill. And this particular tune is Sleeping Pill by Luna off the album Bewitched.